Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Anyone who claims to care about the environment has to acknowledge also hypocrisy. But that doesn't have to like stop our efforts in their tracks.
Hi, everyone. Today I'm with Jonathan Safran Foer, who is one of the most accomplished authors and thinkers of his generation. I first met Jonathan, quite a few years ago when he published an amazing book, Eating Animals. That was not your first book, though, was it, Jonathan?
No, and it's not the first time we met.
Oh, you tell me.
We met when, even before then, when I published Everything is Illuminated, I came out to your farm, unless I dreamt this, which is also possible. But there's a detail from that afternoon that I remember really vividly, which was that whatever the piece was before me that you were doing involved smoothies, and you had a bunch of smoothies on the table. And after we had done our segment, I said, could I drink one of those smoothies? And you said, you want to drink one of those smoothies? I said, yeah, they look delicious, and they're just sitting there. And for whatever reason, you thought it was the funniest thing you'd ever heard.
How was the smoothie?
Who can remember? I don't know. All smoothies are the same, ultimately.
But I always liked you because I always liked your books. And it's just incredible the career you've had as one of the literary world's most accomplished writers. You gained the literary world's attention with your best-selling fiction book, starting with Everything is Illuminated. And you've also written best-selling nonfiction books that explore factory farming, which really attracted me and really appealed to me and my daughter, a vegetarian, but also global warming. You have focused on that. And the latest book is We Are the Weather. We have so much to talk about, and it's so nice to see you again. It just happened a couple weeks ago. I was doing a commercial, and it was in a beautiful, beautiful, late 19th century house is it Kensington section of Brooklyn?
It's, some people call it Ditmas Park, some people call it Prospect Park South.
Yeah, right near Prospect Park, which is one of my favorite parks, by the way, and I love the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, and I love the Brooklyn Museum. But I was in this house, and my dressing room was upstairs, this very steep, beautiful staircase, and it was in a bedroom, and I'm looking around. Every wall was covered with shelving, which was full of books. And I'm looking and looking and looking in the hallway, too. In the hallway, there are books in Hebrew, in German, in French, and Italian. But there's multiples of each book. And I'm saying, who would have so many books in the same book in all these languages? And then I saw the author, and it was you. So you had copies of all the different translations of all your different books. And then I realized it was you. I looked you up in my phone, and I called Jonathan, and we chatted for a little while. I think he was horrified that I was in his bedroom. Were you horrified I was in your bedroom?
I had been dreaming about it for 20 years.
Well, welcome to my podcast.
Thank you.
And you look great. I told him as I walked in the door today that he looks like a man now, because the last time I saw you, you looked more like an older boy.
I suspect that's coded language, and what you're saying is...
No, it's not. It's not coded at all. You do look more mature.
Decrepit.
No, you don't look at any of those things.
I came here from NYU where I teach, and I take a nap every single day. That's the secret to my relative youthful looks.
Oh, good.
And
how long a nap?
20 minutes.
Oh.
Sometimes I take two.
Yeah, naps are good. I am a napper also.
You take it every day?
Well, I'm in the car, so I sometimes nap in the car on right. my way to someplace. And I think it is rejuvenating and good for you because I don't sleep at night. Do you sleep at night?
I have problems at night.
Me too.
Yeah. You don't sleep by choice or you don't sleep?
I just don't sleep.
You want to sleep and you can't sleep.
Yeah.
And is your mind spinning with things?
Or? No, I read or I watch a movie or, yeah. you know, I'm addicted to my iPad.
Right. That's, of course, terrible to do when you can't sleep.
Yes.
Any kind of screen is a bad idea.
You go down the rabbit hole with whole series. I can watch I can binge anything at night, all night long.
Me too.
So anyway, well, back to more serious matters. Jonathan is a very active person, father of three, and you have a new baby.
Yep, 15 months old, 16 months old.
And good? It's fun?
She's great. She's a girl, which is a new experience for me and utterly different. Exactly the same and utterly different, but I've been enjoying it a lot.
Well, you recently visited the Vatican, which interested me tremendously because I was raised a Catholic and we revered the various popes. I did meet Pope John once when I was visiting Cuba. He was there to meet with Castro, and I was sent down by CBS to cover the visit. And it was that same visit when Monica Lewinsky's bomb dropped. So everybody left Cuba and I was left there with Pope John. And it was a very unusual situation, but I got to know Cuba pretty well. But Pope John, what a delightful man he was. How is Pope Francis?
Well, he's everything I was hoping for. I'm not a Catholic, as you know, and I don't know that much about Catholicism. I don't know that much about the Pope. But I got an email on like a Wednesday that said the Pope is going to be delivering a paper, Laudate Deum. It was a kind of sequel to a paper he'd released a couple years before about climate change and about the church's responsibility, Catholics' responsibility, and as he put it, the responsibility of people of goodwill. And they said,
"Who sent you the letter?"
His like right hand guy, whatever that title would be. And they said, "Do you want to come next week to give a little talk about it?"
How wonderful.
How wonderful, but I thought, this is my little brother, or, you know, who sent me this email?
You thought it was a joke?
I did think it was
really?
A joke. Yeah.
Did it come on fancy papal stationery?
Well, it was an email.
Oh, an email. Oh,
yeah, but
oh.
It did have a fancy little stamp at the bottom.
Yeah.
And the English was like, sort of like questionable enough to feel authentic. I know somebody in Rome whose brother works for—
I hope you saved that. Did you save that email?
Of course. Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, a couple days later, I found myself in the Vatican, and— I got to meet him for a little bit. I brought my daughter, which was really special. In advance of meeting him, I asked his people, you know, what's the protocol? I've never met a pope before. Am I supposed to look him in the eyes? Do I kiss a ring? Do I bow? Do I not touch him? What do I do? And they sent me back a two-sentence text. They said, "Be normal. He's normal." That's all they said. Be normal.
Nice?
He's normal.
Isn't that nice?
And he's one of these people, and you don't meet that many of them in the course of a life, who walks in a room and you just know he's special. He doesn't even have to say anything. He just, obviously.
Isn't it great when you meet that?
Oh, it's amazing. And he was just drawn to my daughter. You know, there was in that room, there was a Nobel Prize winner for physics. There was an incredible young woman.
This is the baby daughter you took?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
How great.
Yeah.
Did he bless her?
Probably. who knows? He gave her a rosary, you know.
He did?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah. He tickled her, which was blessing enough. And then we had this like press conference where he had these different speakers. And the way that he runs his organization, I found just incredibly impressive and inspiring. I said, "What should I talk about?" I said, "Whatever you want to talk about, whatever his paper moves you to say." "For about how long should I speak?" 10 minutes, 15 minutes, but whatever you're moved to say. "Should I send you my remarks before I give them?" They said, "No, there's no need for that." And there were four or five people. Carlo Petrini, you know him, the slow food. He was one of the speakers. And we just got up and we said whatever we wanted to say. In America,
You would have been produced to death, right?
Produced to death. Yeah. I would have been vetted to death, produced to death.
And this was distributed to the public how?
So it was the official release of this paper of his, a pamphlet. It's maybe like 40 pages. you can find it online and anywhere, and it's really worth reading. It's an incredibly impressive document. It's more progressive than any elected world leader would say. So they had, I don't know, 200, 300 journalists there, and we gave our talks, and then it was disseminated through their newspapers and magazines.
Yeah. Sure. Well, global warming certainly is abstract. It's overwhelming. It's frightening to all of us. And to me, it's kind of especially depressing and at the same time kind of enlightening. I'm a gardener, so it has affected me a lot. My hobby is gardening. And I just found out that Bedford, New York, which has been traditionally zone 5 on the climate chart, we have, you know, it's for gardeners and growers and farmers, is now a 7. It has warmed, the climate has warmed 2 whole, not degrees, but 2 whole classes up to 7. So it's almost, I can almost grow anything now in a 7. We still will get frosts, and citrus would die if I put them outside, but it's horrifying, horrifying what I can grow now.
Yeah, gardeners see what the rest of us have a harder time seeing.
Yes.
We just don't have a day-to-day experience with it. There are these horrible floods in California.
They're talking about atmospheric rivers now, which means there's a river in the sky dumping 8 inches on Los Angeles, and Brentwood had 8 inches of rain in 1.5 days. That is an extraordinary amount of water, and plants can't take it. The houses can't take it. The hillsides in California certainly can't take it. And they're so worried that another storm is coming and then the mudslides will start. But all of this has prompted you to write a really interesting book, We Are the Weather. Can you tell us about that book?
So I should say I never thought I would write nonfiction. I never really wanted to. When I was younger, writers I know seem to break into 2 categories. Those who grew up and always knew they wanted to write, were always reading, like kids who had books under their covers with a flashlight when they were little.
That's me.
See, that was not me.
Oh, was it?
No, I came to reading later. I'm still not.
You had a lot of books in your room. Who's reading all those books?
Well, first of all, as you said, they're all
No, they weren't. Because I was looking at titles of all the books in your
room. No, I like to read, but I bet you read more books than I do.
I used to read more. As time disappears, I have read fewer and fewer books a year, but I did read so much under the covers with a flashlight.
Yeah. So I came to it kind of late, and not because I loved literature, but I loved just a certain kind of expressiveness and freedom, a way of like...
And you had an imagination.
Exercising my imagination,
of course.
Yeah. And so that got me into fiction. And then nonfiction, it was really born out of this concern that I had, and I've had since I was a little kid, which I think a lot of kids have, which is, why do we eat meat?
An anxiety.
Yeah, an anxiety about it. And not even anxiety, but an acknowledgement that our relationship to animals, every story I received about what animals are and how to treat them was sort of like made a kind of sense to me, except for food. So you have a family dog, you treat it well, you certainly don't abuse it. You know, you try to give it pleasure and you act as if it has some sort of experience of its existence. I had stuffed animals that I was like tucked in with. My parents read me stories when I was a kid that had animals for heroes. And then there's this other thing we do where we keep them in cages and dismember them and eat them. So that doesn't mean it's wrong. There are a lot of things that kids find weird that aren't wrong. You're just not mature enough to understand the way that they are a part of life. If you showed a kid, you know, an image of people having sex, the kid would freak out and think, this is the most horrible thing I've ever seen. So I was an on and off vegetarian for a lot of my life. At times I was really on, and I was kind of like annoyingly inflexible about it, and probably a little self-righteous. And at times I was really off, and I would eat anything that was in front of me. But it wasn't until my first child was born that I thought, you know, I really need to figure out what's going on here, both in the sense of how this industry works and also how I actually feel and like what my own limits for change are. There are a lot of things that I think would be great that I don't do because they're impossible.
Well, in your book about climate change, you make very bold statements. If we skipped animal products before dinner, we could make a huge impact. What does that mean?
So, you know, I don't actually think of that as a bold statement, or not any more than it's bold to say if you jump from a building, you're going to fall toward the ground. Like it's a science. And the science at this point is really unambiguous.
But does it mean don't eat any meat all day long, but you can have it for dinner?
What is behind the statement is that meat is one of the biggest problems we're facing when it comes to climate change. And we cannot meet the goals of the Paris Climate Accords without eating a lot less meat. There are a lot of ways to do it. It's not certainly not a binary. Like, everybody doesn't have to become a vegan or vegetarian.
Well, you know Mark Zuckerberg's solution. Do you know his?
He kills.
If he eats meat, he has killed it.
Yeah.
Personally.
I find that dumb, I have to be honest. You know, what does killing it yourself prove? First of all, most people obviously can't do that. It's an enormous luxury that he's able to do it. And I would like shudder to think about the carbon footprint of his hunting habits.
Taking the jet to some place where there's a cow that you can shoot.
Yeah. Doing it, you know, I don't need to murder somebody to know that murder is wrong. I don't need to commit any number of other like ethical offenses to know it's wrong.
I raise my own food, 8 of my beautiful turkeys. They were a year old and they're eating a tremendous amount of food. They are giving me turkey manure, which I put into the compost and feed it back to the earth, and the forest will grow better, et cetera, et cetera. If you're going to ever serve a turkey, you might as well raise it yourself. If you can. I bought a pair of them at the Poultry Congress last year.
What's the Poultry Congress?
Oh, this wonderful, wonderful congress where people who grow their own backyard poultry for eggs primarily, and also for beautiful birds and keeping species alive. Mm. People come from all over with prize birds of every kind of species of chicken, for example. Mm. I mean, amazing. I go every year because I want to see all the different geese and all
cool.
She said, oh, don't expect any babies this year. But next year, you'll get a whole big crop from these two. And I got 13 babies the first year out of their eggs. Very fertile, very, very like well done.
Cosseeds.
Yes. Yeah. And so I have my own turkeys. But I do that with chickens, and I do it with guinea fowl, and I do it with pheasant. I have all kinds of birds. But I don't feel guilty. I feel good if I have to eat meat that I have. I know what they've eaten and how they've lived. And they're not tortured, and they're not badly raised.
I mean, I don't
raise anything big. No cows.
So I don't write about, and I don't talk about, and honestly, I don't think that much about cases like that. I don't have a problem with them at all. The problem is the dominant industry, which is responsible for 99.9% of the animals that we eat. You know, you're talking about your turkeys. You put them together, they made other turkeys.
Yeah.
There's not a supermarket in the United States where you can buy a turkey that was not the product of artificial insemination.
I agree. I know.
Because their bodies have been bred to grow so big that they're literally incapable of having sex anymore.
Yeah.
So the notion of that as like our symbol of harvest, our symbol of gratitude, is truly insane.
Yeah. You know, it has changed tremendously. And I totally understand that. And it has not yet driven me to vegetarianism, but I cannot go to a supermarket and buy a steak. I just can't. I have to go to a local farmer and buy something that he raised in his pasture that looks good, tastes good.
Well, I think we can move toward
more
a system like that.
Yes.
It's just, but to do so, we'll have to eat a lot less.
Oh, yes.
Both because it will be more expensive.
Explain about the gases that arise from just the manure of all these animals in feedlots. I mean, that's more, isn't that the biggest cause of pollution in the United States?
Of methane.
Of yes.
Yeah. And it's not only the burping and farting of cows, it's also an incredibly energy intensive industry. So you have to put in about between 7 and 20 calories into an animal to get 1 calorie out of the animal. So living on a planet with finite resources and an ever-increasing human population and needs for food, it's just unsustainable. And it's not like a provocative opinion. When I was writing We Are the Weather, I spoke to a lot of climate scientists. And I met some who are vegetarian, and I met some who eat meat once a day. But I didn't meet one who disputed the fact that this is an enormous piece of the puzzle.
And yet they have not stopped eating meat.
Yeah, but who would I be to judge that? Mm-hmm. I have not stopped flying. I have not stopped driving cars. You know?
I was going to ask you, do you drive a car?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, gas car or electric?
I had an electric car, and then I found myself getting in trouble all the time, you know, running out of charge with my kids and whatnot. So now I have a gas car. I'm lucky in Brooklyn not to really have to drive hardly at all. But, I mean, we are all massive. Anyone who claims to care about the environment has to acknowledge also hypocrisy. But that doesn't have to like stop our efforts in their tracks. You know, I think when we feel vulnerable, and climate change makes a lot of us feel vulnerable, there's a temptation to race toward these binaries, these all or nothing. Like, if you acknowledge that meat is problematic, then it makes one feel like a hypocrite not to go all the way, you know, and become mm-hmm. a vegan or a vegetarian. If one acknowledges that climate change is a catastrophe, you can feel like a hypocrite if you still drive or fly.
Or take an airplane, right.
But there's no progress in that, because the reality is we're human beings. We're not ethical or logical robots. And
until we are, we're going to keep flying and we're going to keep driving.
Yeah. And the good news is, like, meeting the goals of the Paris Climate Accords doesn't require us to
give that all up.
To give it all up. It just requires us to live with a kind of moderation we're not used to, and that probably scares us more as a prospect than it would actually be uncomfortable as reality.
No, but I remember growing up, you had one car. I mean, this is a family of eight. We had one car. We turned the lights off when we left a room. We ate moderate amounts of store-bought food, and we traveled not too much. But we did travel. This was, you know, 50, 60 years ago. And now it's just snowballed so drastically that we have to take some steps. I travel a lot, and I just went to Mumbai for the first time in India. I was horrified at the way people live there, the crowded nature of the city, the filth. It's such a difficult place to exist, and polluted beyond belief. And nothing's being done about it.
Mm.
So it's heartbreaking, worrisome, really worrisome.
The trick is, this stuff is heartbreaking when you have occasion to think about it or when you're forced to look at it. And it's incredibly easy to forget when you don't.
Yeah.
So you were in Mumbai, you saw it with your own eyes, you were moved. If you are like me, and you probably are in this way, in a week you'll think about it less. In 2 weeks you'll think about it less.
No, I have a pretty good memory.
And I don't.
And a vivid memory for things that are not pleasant.
And so what do you do with it? Like if you see something like that and...
Well, yeah, I talk about it. Mm-hmm. I ask about it and I learn about it. And what else can we do really except read your books and give a book to everybody about this and hope that more and more and more people will take it seriously. Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Health Aid Kombucha.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feelin' Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
How long does it take you to write a book like We Are the Weather?
That's a tricky question. 2 years? But, you know, there's a great old story someone told me once when I first started writing about Picasso, that a friend of his went to his studio as Picasso was preparing a show, and it was a show of drawings, and there were drawings on all the walls, and they were sort of like naive looking, primitive looking. And his friend said, just between us, like, how much are you going to sell that for? And Picasso said, I don't know, the equivalent today of $1 million, mm-hmm. $5 million. He said, Picasso, how long did it take you to draw that? The implication being, it looks like it took 30 seconds to draw. And Picasso said, that one took me about 76 years, which is mm-hmm. how old he was at the time. So, you know, there's different kinds of
ways of
work. Like everything that one does leads to where you are. But then there's also the time when you're like sitting down and trying to put words on a page. So,
But you're prolific.
I used to be.
Huh? You used to be more prolific, really? Yeah, yeah. Do you think you were more prolific? Your first book came out in what year?
That was in 2002, which is easy to remember because it was right after 2001.
Okay. And that is Everything is Illuminated.
Yeah.
Tell us, what's the storyline in Everything is Illuminated, if you have not read this beautiful book?
So I should say I have not read that beautiful book since I wrote it. So I hope I get this right. It is about a young American who shares my name, Jonathan Safran Foer, who goes to the Ukraine searching for a woman who supposedly saved his grandfather during the war. That's half the book. The other half, which is woven through, is a kind of imagined history of this village that he goes to. And
has that village been destroyed?
That village has been destroyed many times. The last time it was destroyed was during World War II, and it wasn't rebuilt.
Oh,
yeah. But you ask a good question. You know, I don't know what that area
looks
is
like
undergoing
now.
Right now. Yeah.
Horrifying.
Yeah.
Your maternal grandmother inspired that book.
She did. She was born in Poland and lost her family. She escaped east. She was a member in some socialist youth groups and assumed that because of that, she would be a bigger target. So she, with a friend, walked east, the equivalent of walking across the United States, I don't know, 1.5 or 2 times, ended up coming back, meeting my grandfather. My mother was born in a DP camp, and then they came to the States a couple years later.
Amazing stories. It's just amazing stories that what people went through. You studied philosophy in school. So did you know you were going to be a writer, or what were you thinking when you went to college?
I wish I could do it again. My oldest son is going to college next year.
Oh.
It's given me an opportunity to think about how wasted the experience was on me. You know, I just didn't know what I was doing.
Where'd you go to college?
To Princeton. And it's not even like I had so much fun. I didn't know how to enter the stream, you know? Yeah. It felt like I was on the banks looking at the stream pass by me. So, you know, I studied and there were things that I liked. Philosophy, I ended up choosing at the last minute because I had to have a major. I didn't get seriously into writing until probably my junior year. And I had Joyce Carol Oates as a professor.
I love her.
Yeah, have you ever had a conversation with her?
No, I have not, but I love her.
I think you would enjoy her company
a lot. No, I've read every single one of her books. I don't know about the most recent ones, but I read everything. Mm. She was incredible.
Yeah, she's
a good teacher.
Remember when I was saying that the Pope is one of those people who walks into a room and you say, this is a special person? Joyce is very much like that as well. So she was my teacher, and she was the first person ever to say to me, hey, you should take this seriously. You know, there's... What would happen if you really tried?
She liked your writing.
She did, yeah. And
encouraging.
It is encouraging. It's very encouraging. I'm not unique in that way. She's started a lot of writing careers. She would write letters to me at my parents' house during vacations saying, you might think about reading this book. I was thinking about your last story. It got kind of thin at the end. Here's how you might. She has as much success as anybody would ever need. She has no need to become involved
in
that.
Yes, she does. She's a teacher.
She's a teacher.
And that's why she does that.
Yeah.
Because she actually cares.
Yeah.
And that's such a fantastic, fantastic thing.
I literally owe my life to it.
How nice.
Yeah.
How nice. I'm the daughter of two teachers, and they cared. They cared that we learned and that we were encouraged. And that's the goal of a teacher. How fabulous that it was Joyce Carol Oates.
Yeah.
Lucky man. So you've written not only fiction, but also nonfiction. Similar processes for you? Or
no,
which
totally
is harder?
Different.
Which is harder?
Fiction is much harder.
It is.
Nonfiction is more laborious. You know what you have to do and you do it. With fiction, what's so tricky is not knowing what you have to do, not knowing what the destination is.
Do you do an outline?
No. I don't.
You just go?
I just go, which is, I used to think was really inefficient I don't know. I have a friend who's a writer who once said, writing a novel is like pulling teeth out of your penis.
out of your penis.
Yeah, very, very uncomfortable.
Oh, jeez. You know?
And I find it's gotten harder, not easier, over time. Yeah.
Now you're teaching.
I teach. Okay. But I've been teaching for a while. I've been teaching more.
What's your course at NYU?
I teach two different classes. They're both workshops. One is fiction, one is nonfiction. My classes are almost always 12 students, and each week three of them will turn something in, and we just talk about it. There's no like reading that they do other than each other's work. There's no lecture that I give. It's very conversational. There tends to be a lot of camaraderie.
Have you found another Jonathan Safran Foer in that group?
Oh, I found much better than that.
Yeah.
I've had amazing, amazing students. You know, one of the great lessons of teaching is really talented people and really smart people are not that rare. They're not as rare as you would think. You know, every semester I've ever taught, I've had at least one student that I've been jealous of, whose talent I've been jealous of.
It's so great when you're jealous, isn't it?
It's the best. I mean, it's the worst
as well.
But.
No, I love finding somebody I'm jealous of.
Yeah.
And it makes me better in a funny way. And I'm sure it does that to you too.
It does. I guess I've been fortunate that people that I have been jealous of, I've also liked, which makes quite a bit of difference, and respected. And, you know, their success feels like my success because I respect them.
Right.
I've had some truly amazing students.
As a reader, who are your favorite authors?
I tend to read more nonfiction than fiction. I tend to read probably even more poetry than nonfiction.
Oh, really? Ah.
Yeah. It's a tricky thing reading when you're a writer. The old joke about the gynecologist who comes home Friday night and his wife is in lingerie on the bed and she taps the bed next to her, has a little romantic music playing, there's whatever, roses in the vase. You know where this is going? Maybe.
I can guess.
Okay.
He's a gynecologist.
Well, he says, if I have to look at another one of those things, I'm going to kill myself.
Right.
I have sort of that relationship to books. I find it, I cannot read in the way that I used to read, you know, before I was a writer, because now I...
Never marry a gynecologist, ladies.
Yes. Never marry a gynecologist, but writers are safe.
So three of your books have been adapted to films. Everything is Illuminated, Extremely Loud, and Incredibly Close. Who was in Everything is Illuminated?
Well, Liev Schreiber wrote and directed it and is one of my oldest and best friends. I met him right at the beginning of my career. Before my first book came out, it was excerpted in The New Yorker, and he bought the rights to it.
Oh.
And we just became friends and never stopped. In fact, when you were in my house, when you displaced me, I was staying at his house.
Oh, you were?
Yeah,
oh.
So just to bring it all together. Elijah Wood was in that movie.
Oh. What about Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close? How was that adapted?
Stephen Daldry was the director. Eric Roth was the writer. And Tom Hanks and Sandra Bullock were in it. And in both cases, I didn't really have anything to do with the
You just sold the books.
Yeah.
For the movies.
Yeah.
And what about Eating Animals? Did you have a lot to do with that?
A little bit more,
yeah.
Because documentaries are kind of labors of love.
Right.
Natalie Portman produced it. Christopher Quinn was the name of the director. And I think he did a great job. It's such an important conversation to have, but it's a really tricky one.
It is.
Because it just makes people feel
so
scared.
Uncomfortable, right?
Yeah, and defensive. It makes me feel scared and defensive. Mm. So finding a way to both speak honestly about it, but also accessibly and to like, create room just for inconsistency and to create room for things like cravings and family culture and religion and celebration, gathering. It's hard. It's a really hard balance to strike.
What are the most surprising aspects of seeing your works translated to the screen, and do you watch your movies more than once?
No, I don't watch them more than once.
You're never tempted to go back and see that first movie again?
No, not for any. It's like
you know it.
I mean, if I were to play for you a message you left on my cell phone, you probably have like an uncomfortable relationship with your own voice, right?
Yeah.
So now imagine that it was somebody who was adapting you, like impersonating you, who left a message on my cell phone. You might say, oh, that's funny, or that's interesting, or hey, that person did a great job, but you would have a discomfort. So I have a discomfort. I don't read my books either after I write them.
I always think, I don't want to sit in an edit room. That's one thing I hate to do, is sit in an edit room, because I know what I did, I know what I see, I know what I can see, what I see what I did in my head. I don't have to see it on the TV. And yet it is surprising sometimes, surprisingly bad and sometimes surprisingly good when I finally see something.
Yeah. I was glad they did it because the scale.
It's good for all of us that they did it because, you know, the visual now, the screen is where we get most of our information. And I think people are more anxious to see things adapted for the screen than even read them, sorry to say.
Well, but it's not even close.
Yeah.
Like the scale of.
A viewership is way bigger than readership, right?
Oh, God. You know, a film that is considered an absolute bomb, you know, that dies the quietest death.
Is seen by more people than...
Is read by most bestsellers,
yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah. So, you know, that's the world we live in. What are you going to do?
I know. Well, I had a magazine that has already gone by the wayside, and that was 40 years old after thousands of issues. And now... And now, you know, just people miss it. I know they miss it because I get letters from them, but it's the same kind of thing. Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Health Aid Kombucha.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.
What's it like to have a family and raise them in Brooklyn? Is that where you grew? You didn't grow up in Brooklyn, did
no,
you?
No, I grew up in D.C.
Yeah.
In D.C., D.C. Whenever I tell someone I'm from D.C., they always say, are you from D.C.? Are you from Potomac or Bethesda or Silver Spring? I grew up in D.C. and lived there my life until I went to school. And then immediately after school, I moved to New York. I moved to Jackson Heights, Queens, where I was for... Have you ever been to Jackson Heights?
Yes.
Yeah, Jackson Heights is the best. That was my original sin, was leaving Jackson Heights.
Oh, I went to Dr. Rashitan there. He was a chiropractor type in Jackson Heights. Crazy place.
One of my recent nighttime hobbies to sort of sand down the corners at the end of a day and just like relax myself, I'll watch videos of things. And I find that I get drawn to really unusual subjects for no obvious reason. And a recent one that I've been taking a lot of pleasure in is chiropractic adjustments of dogs.
And it works.
It works incredibly well.
And horses. You should see.
I have seen horses
I have
as
a
well.
Chiropractor who does my horses.
I've seen that too.
And it helps them so much.
Yeah. I'm going to do it. I'll do it.
Okay. What's it like to raise your kids in Brooklyn?
I think about that a lot. I think about it a lot, especially now that I have a very young child again and can, you know, now I have the benefit of knowing then what I know now. Brooklyn is, if I were to live in New York City, if I were to live in a city in the United States, I can't imagine living anywhere other than Brooklyn. In fact, I can't imagine living anywhere other than my neighborhood. I like it so very much.
But you have a beautiful neighborhood. It is
beautiful
so,
neighborhood, yeah.
It's so unusual.
It is.
Unusually beautiful. And those houses on your street and the streets around you, these are giant mansions. How many square feet is your house?
I don't know.
It's huge, though. It's three stories high. I didn't look all around it. I'm sure you did. No, I didn't. No, I'm quite sure you did. I did not. I only went up to the second floor, to your bedroom, to the hallway. Mm. I went into your library, into your kitchen.
I have a list of everything that was there, by the way. I'm going to double check it. And, I couldn't find my deodorant this morning.
Oh, I did not take that. And your and that beautiful living room. It's giant, giant living room. It's like three living rooms running into each other. And big, beautiful windows. It has architectural, very fine architectural detail. And who built that house? You know?
I don't know.
You haven't done research on that?
No, when I
That's a novel, you know.
When I moved,
that neighborhood is a novel.
You know, it's, Sophie's Choice, the film.
Was filmed there?
Was filmed there, yeah.
Oh.
When I moved into that house, no one had lived in it for like 4 years. There were like weeds growing inside. Yeah, it was a pretty disgusting place. So it took some
Children going to be writers?
I have no idea. I don't think so, but maybe. My younger son is really into filmmaking.
Oh, he is?
Yeah, and he's 15. He just turned 15, actually, 2 days ago. And he's truly great at it.
Mm.
And I know that like a dad is not the most trustworthy. In a way, it's harder to make predictions like that now than it's ever been before, because who knows what the hell the world's going to look like. Like, you saw this new Apple thingy.
I've put those goggles on. Have you done that yet?
No.
Oh, it's horrifying. Yeah, you lose all sense of reality right away, and you get all disoriented because there's so much going on right in front of you, so close and colorful and brilliant. You should rewrite your first book with goggles on.
Well, I'm on the hook, actually.
The title is perfect.
Yeah, it's true. Maybe they'll be my corporate sponsor. We could work something out.
They could
be. I'm actually on the hook to write a nonfiction book about technology.
Oh, good.
Yeah, because it's something I think about a lot, and it bothers me a lot, but I don't know what to do with my feelings about it because
it's the same thing as eating animals.
Yeah.
We are trapped in technology.
Yeah.
It is not going to go away. Did you watch the hearings this week?
There were these
congressional hearings this week on TikTok and on Instagram, making us feel so, so bad that these platforms exist. And I use both platforms. And if you use them responsibly and playfully, they're okay. Mm. But boy, when you lose them inappropriately, they arouse a tremendous amount of ire. And there's nobody monitoring them, really. And then they complain about it, and then they want to fire everybody, and they want the stocks to go down, and they want these companies to go away. They're not going to go away. So that is a very good book subject for you. If you could get it, if you can look at it the way you looked at eating animals, that would be, it would make so many enemies for you. You would love it.
I would love it. You know, the other day when I came, if you just think about why we're having this conversation right now, you were in my house, and you sort of had a very analog experience of moving around the objects in my house. And you even said, like, there were nice architectural details. I noticed these books were in these languages. They were on bookshelves. Some of the bookshelves have they're barrister bookshelves with a glass door. Some of them are open. Everything has like a character. And in response to that, you hand wrote a letter. Yeah, you could have written a text. You could have written an email.
No, I wrote you a little note.
You hand wrote a letter and you put it on my bedside table, which is, you know.
Did you read it?
Of course.
Oh, good. Oh, good. You read it.
And that's where, you know, and then it led to us sitting in these chairs having this conversation. Like, it scares me to think, not scares me, it's a tragedy.
That might not happen in the future.
That might not happen.
And it's on its way.
Yeah.
It's on its way.
When I think about the things I enjoy most in life and that make me feel most alive and grateful to be alive.
It's like the human interaction.
Yeah. Those analog things that you touch and taste and see and engage with your senses and that are interpersonal.
And you must keep that up with your kids. I only have one daughter, but her kids, I want her kids to experience all that I grew up with. I think you're so right about that. It is the human interaction that we have to maintain.
I was walking here from NYU, maybe 20-minute walk, and I found myself looking at my phone as I walked. It's a beautiful day out.
And then you're going to get run over.
I'm going to get run over, or I'm going to miss everything that's going on around
And yes,
me.
And your children will not have a father. Don't do that. Yeah. Do not be reading your phone when you're walking or listening. I don't put earplugs in my ears. I just won't do that because I don't want to miss what's around me.
Yeah.
So if we could only learn how to do that, it would be better.
You know, you mentioned that the magazine is now non-existent. Like, my impression of that magazine was it was almost entirely about how to make things nicer with your hands.
That's right.
Like, here's how you can make a table look a little nicer. And believe it or not, a table that looks a little nicer inspires a slightly different kind of conversation, a slightly different kind of appreciation.
It does. It does. That's what we were. We were crafters, inspirers, and how to, you know, do-it-yourselfers.
Yeah.
And if you didn't want to do it yourself, at least you knew how it had to be done.
I think that I've given a lot of thought to this recently. I read a book called The Architecture of Happiness not that long ago. And the point that the author was making, it's going to sound like he's saying nothing at all. But when you start to like sit with it and really think about it, it can make an impression, which is the spaces that we are in influence the kinds of thoughts and feelings and experiences we have. So if you walk into Notre Dame, it's almost hard not to have a deep thought, you know, or a deep feeling.
No more Notre Dame for a while.
No more Notre Dame. So let's say St. Patrick's. If you walk into a McDonald's, it's almost hard not to have a cheap styrofoam thought or feeling. Okay. And, you know, that extends not only beyond our physical spaces, but the kinds of people we spend time with. And the, you know, putting aside 45 minutes or an hour to have a conversation with someone you haven't seen in a long time, it's like a kind of space.
Well, I'm very glad that we got together, and I'm very glad to hear about your work, about your progress as a very, very fine and acclaimed author in the American genre of literature, and I wish you well in all your future endeavors.
Well,
I'm not going to ask you about your new book, but I hope when it is out that you will come back and speak to me on our podcast.
I would love that, and I hope it won't be as long as it was since our last conversation.
I hope so. Thank you very much, Jonathan Safran Foer. And be sure to pick up We Are the Weather to learn more about climate change. Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Health Aid Kombucha.
You don't have to hop a plane to see the world. This month's Free This Week picks on Xfinity brings you around the globe. Experience life at a European resort in the hit comedic drama Seaside Hotel from Walter Presents. Watch romance blossom abroad in a Scottish love scheme from Hallmark Movies Channel. Celebrate Earth Month with planet-saving docuseries like EcoEye with Duncan Stewart on Magellan TV. And be transported to your happy place with iHeartRadio's Feeling Good playlist. Just say Free This Week into your Xfinity voice remote.